some very bad news on Friday. The news that Ricky Tiedemann, the team's top pitching prospect, is headed for Tommy John surgery. So he will be out this year a good chunk, if not all of next year. That means three of the Blue Jays' top pitching prospects are out for the year. Landon Moraitis, Brandon Barriera, who has, in the latest Baseball America updated top 30 for the system, dropped dramatically because we just haven't really seen him pitch. Three of the team's top pitching prospects undergoing Tommy John or internal brace or the combination procedure this season and will be out this year into next year. Alek Manoah, similar story there. There's also Adam Macko, who's on the IL at AA. He would be the next pitcher prospect on that list. And Treya Savage, who ranks in as the team's number two pitching prospect when he signs, still hasn't signed, which isn't the end of the world, but it's at least a little curious given they've signed pretty much everyone else. So that's how the weekend starts on Friday. Then, while you're out for dinner with your friends before you all head to the Blue Jays game, Jimmy Garcia gets traded. I guess that technically happened a little earlier in the afternoon. Anyway, not when we were on air. Thanks a lot. The Jays trade Jimmy Garcia to the Seattle Mariners for a pair of prospects. And I'm getting a text from J.D. Bunkus that Treya Savage is going to get done soon. So no sweat there. Worth mentioning still, it would be nice to see him pitching before the end of the year, but no sweat in that case. Anyway, Jimmy Garcia gets traded before Friday's game. He gets dealt to the Mariners for a pair of prospects. Later in the weekend, the Jays would trade Nate Pearson to the Cubs for a pair of prospects and Danny Jansen to the Red Sox for a trio of prospects. So Danny Jansen, Jimmy Garcia, Nate Pearson out. Seven prospects in those seven have all been assigned to the minor leagues. A couple of call-ups to backfill, but nobody you're all that excited about. Brian Servin's going to fill in a catcher. The Ryan Burr, Yuri Rodriguez, Zach Pop trio up to fill in the bullpen spots. And then what happened on the field was quite interesting. The Jays walk it off on Friday. Ernie Clement coming through to walk that one off. Cool. It's a lot of fun. You like to have those moments still. Saturday rolls around. Kevin Gausman gives them a complete game. Shakes off one bad inning and is otherwise pretty darn dominant. Throws a season high in pitches, gives them the full nine innings. And then Jose Berríos gives them his best start in a couple of months here. Goes seven, allowing just one. The Jays sweep the Rangers, who are the defending champs, who came into this series thinking, hey, we've done enough work, maybe we're buyers. Now they're getting talked about as sellers, potentially. They just pitched Michael Lorenzen as a starter on Saturday. He got chased in the first inning. He came in as a reliever on Sunday because John Gray left that game before even throwing a pitch due to a groin issue. So you stick it to the Rangers, who, if you think back to August last year, it's kind of funny. The Rangers come into town and sweep the Blue Jays over four in August last year. And the takeaway is, well, you're going to make the playoffs, but you're probably not that good. Then the Rangers come into town right before the deadline as the Jays are selling this year. They sweep the Rangers, and it's like, you're not going to make the playoffs, but you know what? Maybe you're not that bad. Now, this season is what it is. They remain seven games under 500 and 7.5 out of a wild card spot with a lot of teams to jump. It's not happening this year. But you do remember quickly how if this offense is clicking and if Kevin Gausman and Jose Berríos are pitching like Kevin Gausman and Jose Berríos, things could have been different this year. The American League is not all that good. Baltimore's fallen off dramatically, 5-10 in their last 15. The Yankees have been one of the worst teams in baseball over the last 6 weeks. It is a good reminder that this season, while lost, is really a big missed opportunity as well. This could have been a year. The Jays could have got off to a better start. They wouldn't be selling here. They'd be buying instead. They'd be competing. The wild card, the American League East is still even kind of open here. So that part's disappointing. If you care about the outcomes of the game still, this weekend went really well. They swept the Rangers and their starters gave them 16 innings over Saturday and Sunday. So they only used two relievers over Saturday, Sunday. That is relevant because they play a doubleheader today against the Baltimore Orioles. They play at 3:00. It'll be Yariel Rodriguez against Zach Eflin. Yes, Zach Eflin, just saw him Wednesday as a member of the Tampa Bay Rays. He's a Baltimore Oriole now. He's going to start game one of that doubleheader. Game two will be Bowden Francis and Cade Povich, both getting called up from AAA as the 27th men for their respective teams. The Jays will play again tomorrow, right after the trade deadline. So the trade deadline is 6 p.m. tomorrow. We'll be on air 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. We've got a good show today. We'll have a loaded show tomorrow, obviously 4 hours with a ton of guests on. Later today in the show, we're going to talk to Ginny Searle of Baseball Prospectus about some of the trades that have happened. We'll talk to Kevin Brown of the Orioles broadcast to set up this doubleheader and talk about some of the Orioles action. Lindsey Dunn is going to join us around 10:35. She drove Kevin Kiermaier to work the other day, and they did a sing-along in the car. She's going to play some of those clips for us. We'll talk about Kevin Kiermaier potentially retiring and now day-to-day with a hip contusion after crashing into the wall on the weekend. He was a potential trade candidate, remains a potential trade candidate, but you don't really want to see that. And then we're also going to talk to, in a few minutes here, Emelian Petrie, who was the Rays' second-round pick out of Kentucky, a kid from Quebec who has played his way from part-time, I'm only getting four at-bats the whole season at Kentucky, to an everyday guy, to a starring role at Kentucky, to a second-round pick. We chatted with him on Friday. That's a fun interview. Before we get into that, though, let's talk about the trades that happen. So the Jays send out three different players, and they bring back seven. So again, Nate Pearson to the Cubs, Jimmy Garcia to the Mariners, Danny Jansen to the Red Sox. And none of those players are going to bring back a return that changes the outlook of your franchise. Jimmy Garcia is a very good reliever, but he's a rental. He is expiring, and only limited experience as a closer. Teams probably want to slot him in as an eighth inning or seventh inning against a good part of the order kind of guy. Very useful chip. You're not going to get a Carlos Estevez return for Jimmy Garcia. Pretty solid return regardless. They get Jonathan Clase from the Mariners, who was the number 13 ranked prospect in Baseball America's midseason update in the Mariners organization, and Jacob Sharp, who was a 17th round pick in 2023. The Nate Pearson trade is a weird one because if you couldn't get much back for Nate Pearson, maybe the thought would be, well, we'll just keep him. He's only going to make $1 million and change in arbitration. The talent is obviously there. There is stuff there, the fastball velocity, the curveball, things like that. But sometimes guys just need to change the scenery. And if you can get anything back for a guy you've soured on, you may as well. They get back Yohindrick Pinango, who was the number 17th ranked prospect in the Cubs system in that Baseball America midseason update and was also a notable riser. They also pick up Josh Rivera, who was the team's third round pick last year, but already has kind of played his way out of prospect status. And then the Danny Jansen trade returns Cutter Coffey, who was the number 41 pick just last year. So a nice, and he signed for almost a $2 million signing bonus. So a nice bit of, not buy low, but that was a guy who was a fringe first round pick just a year and change ago, got a good signing bonus. And now you're getting him as a, you know, not a throw in the Danny Jansen trade, but not even the headline item. The headline item is probably Edison Paulino, who was ranked number 18 in the Red Sox midseason update. You also get Gilberto Bautista, who's a pitcher low in the minor. So let's look at these seven guys a little more closely. And we'll do this throughout the week as well. We'll take a closer look with some of our prospect friends at Baseball America and around baseball as well. But I've done my research on these guys, talked to some people around the org, talked to some scouting types and things like that, dug into the stats, of course, but video where it's available for some of these guys. So Jonathan Clase, number 13 in the Mariners midseason. He has been assigned to AAA Buffalo. He is the nearest to the major leagues. He's already spent a little bit of time in the majors with the Mariners. If Kevin Kiermaier were to be traded, I could absolutely see him on this roster as a fourth outfielder type the rest of the way here. The headline item with him is speed, like super plus speed, 70 grade on the 20 to 80 scale, according to Baseball America. In 2022, he stole 55 bags in the minors. Last year, that jumped to 79. He's stolen 26 in 60 games in the minors this year. That is a skill that this organization is fairly light on, and particularly at the major league level, where they've been consistently in the bottom 10 in stolen bases for a while here. Question, of course, is will he get on base enough for that speed to matter? He is hitting 274 at AAA this year. Because of the speed, he posts generally pretty strong batting average on balls in play. He also walks at a decent clip, but for a guy who's probably going to want to lean on his contact skill, strikes out maybe a little bit too much. Has shown double-digit pop in the minors. He's listed at 5'8", 150, so you wouldn't think there's a lot of power there, but he has a pretty explosive swing. Looks like a strong swing, a strong player there. Eric Longenhagen of Fangraphs called it a dip and rip kind of swing where he'll go down low. That swing type is maybe going to be susceptible to high velocity, things like high in terms of high velocity reading, but also high in the zone. So we'll see. There could be some, there's a reason that, you know, he got a cup of coffee, hasn't stuck at the majors yet. Any prospect you're picking up isn't going to be perfect. The other interesting note about Class A is that he's fairly new to switch hitting, and his swing from the right-handed side has come along around lefties pretty well to where he's pretty split neutral now at AAA this year, which is always a question when a guy introduces switch hitting a little later in his career. The other headline item here, Yohindrick Pinango, number 17 in the Cubs midseason. He's interesting because he started this year at high A for the fourth consecutive year. that he's seen a thing, that's a pretty big red flag. He was also a young international signing, so the Jays will have to make a Rule 5 decision on him this winter, put him on the 40-man or expose him to Rule 5. However, Baseball America had him as one of their notable risers in the Cubs system before that trade, and that was in part because, you know, once you got out of high A, you got to take another look, and he performed well at double A. So, like, you know, if you're killing it at high A, but it's your fourth year there, everyone's going to be a little skeptical. He gets to double A. He plays pretty well. For his hitter type, doesn't strike out a ton. He's had a nice uptick in line drive rate and fly ball rate, so he's doing a better job getting the ball in the air. He does have pretty good exit velocity, shows some strength and things like that. The home run numbers haven't caught up. He'll need to expand that because defensively he's probably just a left fielder, so you're going to have some pop there. He was also a Fangraphs Eric Loggenhagen called him a data darling prospect because he has such good contact rates and very high peak exit velocities. But at the same time, it's a hard swing. It's a long swing. Could be some trouble with velocity as he gets up and to the higher levels here. Edinson Paulinho, who came back from the Red Sox again, number 18 in their system. He's another guy, just turned 22 at double A, but because he's an international signing, he's going to be Rule 5 eligible this offseason. Had a breakout in 2022, regressed a little bit last year, cold start this year, but has really turned it around. He's on the IL right now, so he's been assigned to double A New Hampshire, but he was on the IL at last check. There's some good bat speed there. It's a loud swing. Projects is something, you know, he's going to crush mistakes. You see some of the Baseball America swing videos they put out there. It's like, oh yeah, I see how he could really get around on a mistake on the inner half or something like that. Maybe with that long a swing, that loud a swing, your plate coverage, your ability to recognize pitches and adjust could be a question mark. But he's interesting, and he's a lefty, so there's some real like bench utility piece projection there because he's played second, third, short, center, and left across the minor leagues and has a lefty bat that has some potential. Cutter Coffee, the other notable name there, again, number 41 pick just a couple years ago, $1.85 million signing bonus, so a reasonable second draft, a redraft style candidate. We talked about him on the show earlier in the season, actually, when the Jays were playing the Red Sox, because he had homered in six consecutive games and had seven homers over six games. That's the headline skill there, the power potential. It's possible he sticks at shortstop. Seems like scouting people like him better at third base because the arm's pretty good there and maybe doesn't quite have the range for shortstop. But there's obviously some positional flexibility there. You know, maybe he projects as a power-hitting utility infield type. He was a pitcher in high school as well, so that makes sense why the arm's so good. And then, yeah, the swing, what I got told was the swing type is, he'll pull mistakes. The fastball, he's probably going to have to take the other way. He's not going to be able to get around on higher velocity fastballs. And then there is some swing and miss there. Maybe not the best pitch recognition, but that's an area the Jays have been able to help prospects. So those are the four headline guys. The other three are less notable. Gilberto Bautista is just so far away. He pitched in the Dominican League in 2023. Really good strikeout to walk numbers. Hasn't had as good a command this year in the Florida Coast League. Changeup is probably his best pitch. He throws fastball, cutter, changeup, slider. We'll see. He's gotten assigned to single A Dunedin. Possible he's just intaking there and he'll play because the complex league season is over and things like that. We'll see. Josh Rivera got assigned to double A. Again, third round pick last year. Not really a prospect necessarily, struggling to hit at double A despite being a little bit older, might stick at shortstop defensively, decent exit velocities, but not a ton of extra base hitting there yet. And he's got kind of a long, they call it an uphill swing at Fangraphs. Probably just not a good enough contact hitter yet to be all that relevant. And then Jacob Sharp has been assigned to high A, 17th round pick last year. He's old for single A and is kind of just average at the plate already. The scouting reports on his defense are they're okay. He can throw a runner out. Seems like just an org guy for an org that is very thin on catching depth. So those are the seven prospects. We'll talk more to our prospect people over the course of the week. There will, of course, be additional additions between now and Tuesday, 6 p.m. deadline, we think. So we'll continue to talk about this stuff. We'll continue to set up the trade deadline. Right now, though, let's go to the draft side. The Tampa Bay Rays selected Emiliano Petri out of Kentucky in the second round. We got a chance to talk with him on Friday. Here is that interview. Man, great to talk to you. Congrats on everything the last little bit. How are you feeling?
Oh, feeling great, man. I just got down here in Florida the last couple of days, and it's been awesome. Thank you for having me.
So what is the process like right now? Like, I know you were working out earlier. Is it kind of just like get the lay of the land, do a couple workouts, kind of get onboarded that way?
Yeah. So like I said, I was in St. Pete a couple days ago signing my contract, and now I'm in Port Charlotte, Florida. And I'm just getting acclimated with the heat down here in Florida. Just get things started. So, yeah.
Have they given you any indication yet, or is it still too early for like when you might get in games, what level you might go to, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's still a little early. You know, like I said, I'm just getting acclimated, and hopefully in the next couple of weeks they send me to Charleston.
Yeah, you're ready to roll?
I'm ready. Excited? I can't wait.
Nice. So what is the, I mean, I want to go through the draft process and the pre-draft process with you, because I don't think we get to hear about it a ton. I guess let's start with the combine. We know what the combine's like for like the NFL, obviously, and then the NBA, the like Max Vert and stuff like that. What is the combine for you guys? Like, is it a lot of interview heavy stuff? Like what are the workouts like? What were those couple days like for you?
Yeah, so I actually did not attend the combine. I was still playing at the College World Series.
Right. What a bad question.
Yes, but I actually attended the physicals down in New York City. They flew me out with a couple of my teammates and the guys that weren't able to attend the College World the combine. So they flew me out in New York, and we did a bunch of physicals, just making sure bodies are right, MRIs, AKGs, and stuff like that. So. Yeah, that's kind of what we did at the combine. But I also did a bunch of interviews through Zoom, obviously, because I wasn't able to go to the combine. And but yeah, it's a lot of physical stuff and interviews with a couple teams. So.
Nice. When they're interviewed, they're like, "Oh, we didn't get to see you at the combine." Are you just like, "Yeah, because I was still playing in the national championship tournament."
You can watch me on TV. Yeah.
How was that, man? Like, I know you were a full time guy at Kentucky for 2 years, and you were there prior to that. I'd imagine that's been a blast.
Oh yeah, it was an experience of a lifetime. It's just like what you see on TV. You know, sometimes you watch games on TV and you go to the place and it's like, doesn't seem right. But going to Omaha was awesome. It was exactly what I expected, playing in front of 25,000 people and just a great baseball environment. And especially doing it with Kentucky. I've been there for 3 years. My first year of the program wasn't really good. And then seeing the progress and being part of it was so special. So it was awesome.
So with respect to your 3 years there, what do you think it's taught? Like, I know your first year there, you didn't play very much. And to go from that to being, you know, a regular to then being like a standout player, second round pick, what has that taught you? What do you think that says about you as a player and a person?
I think it's obviously it says a lot. I consider myself a grinder. I just want to work hard, and I do everything possible to help the team win. My main goal is just, when help the team, but no matter what, how it's done, whether it's, you know, putting a bunt down or running down the first baseline, I'm just trying to do everything I can to help the team win. And I think having that mentality definitely helped my development and helped my performance, you know, not worrying about myself too much and just worrying about helping a team win. And I think having that mentality really helped me throughout my development at Kentucky.
When you hear your coach, who's coached a lot of really good baseball players, say that you're as good as any player he's coached, how much confidence does that give you taking this step to the next level?
It means a lot. Coach Mintz is an awesome person, and he's coached a lot of big leaguers. And him putting my name in that category with other guys, it's incredible. Like I said, he's coached, you know, all-stars and a bunch of guys that made it. So it means a lot coming from a guy that has a lot of experience in the SEC, and hopefully he's right. So
he also described you as a brutally honest guy with the team, with yourself, with the players. What does that mean?
So I'm just, you know, I go straight to my teammates. You know, sometimes being a leader, I'm not very vocal. I'll go talk one-on-one with the guys, and my two past years, my sophomore and my junior year at Kentucky, I really took that role of being a leader at Kentucky. And I'm not big on talking in front of a big group. I like talking to people one-on-one, and I'll go straight to the point. And if something has to be said, I'll say it. So I'm not scared of telling people what I think of them. And usually my opinion is somewhat good. But yeah, I just think that it's the best way to send a message out to the people. So,
and then I guess, you know, you mentioned it. Well, one of the factors with that is usually what you're saying is pretty useful, pretty good. That's one thing. And the other is like, are you that honest with yourself as well? And to hear Coach Minge talk about it, sounds like you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm really aware of my performance and how my body works and how my mind works. So, I try to be as really respectful with myself, and at the same time, you know, not lying to myself, because sometimes you can lie to yourself and that's when you kind of go in through the bad hole. But yeah, I try to be really honest with myself. And sometimes, you know, things don't go your way in baseball, you're going to fail 7 times out of 10 and 10 and still be really successful. So yeah.
Okay. So I botched asking you about the combine because you're still playing, but the actual draft, what are those couple of draft days like for you? Like, you get together with family, your reps and stuff like that, teammates, what are you doing the week of the draft or the?
Yes, I was in Lexington the day before the draft, and my dad, you know, came down and picked me up, and we drove back to Quebec, 14-hour drive. We were just talking in the car. So it was a long one, but it felt like, you know, 7-8 hours when you don't see your dad for that long. So you're just talking about everything. But yeah, I just spent the first day with my family. We were just in the basement watching the draft and not expecting my name to get called that high. So we were just watching the draft. And we had a guy at Kentucky that was most likely going to get picked in the first round. So we were watching. And then when he got called up, we got fired up, obviously, and my mom went to bed. And so we were just, you know, watching a draft, but not really paying attention to it. And 5 minutes before the Rays made their pick, I got a call from my agent, and I was like, oh, my God, it's going to happen. Went upstairs, grabbed my mom that was asleep, and we were like, you got to come down, I'm about to get picked. And we lived that moment just with my family.
That's awesome, man. That sounds very special. The teammate part too, man, getting to see your boy drafted and you guys two of the highest drafted Kentucky teammates, you know, ever to share that together. How long did you wait before you bugged him after he got drafted too?
I called him as soon as I got drafted.
Okay.
Just to let him know, because he was not paying attention. He was just celebrating, but I didn't want to, you know, he had a big draft party that I wasn't able to attend to because he lives in Florida, but he enjoyed his time, and it was just good to see his name, you know, popped up in the first round. All the hard work he went through last summer, he went through he tore his ACL in the summer league, and I was there, and I was, you know, painful to watch. And so, you know, seeing him come back from that injury, it was awesome. And now he's a millionaire, so it's very cool.
Yeah, and that's Ryan Waldschmidt, for anyone who doesn't know who we're talking about. Good friends, Ryan. You're going to run into each other in the minors sometime soon, maybe, though. Okay, so you get the call. How, in the lead up to that, like, do you have a sense of which teams are interested in you, or because you could go anywhere from, like, the second to the fifth round, it's like, well, everyone's a little interested in me. What's that aspect of it like?
Yeah, so usually after the college season ends, you have interviews with the front office of whatever teams are interested in you. And I probably had like 20 interviews with front offices. So there was a lot of teams that were interested in me. But, you know, I had a feeling the Yankees, the Guardians, and, you know, I had my teams that are like, okay, these teams are really interested in me. And the Rays, I actually, you know, I had a connection with them. We were pretty online with each other, but I was not expecting Rays. And so when my agent called me and said the Rays are most likely going to pick you, I was like, oh, shit, I'm so down. And, you know, I'm just excited to be with the Rays. Such a great organization at developing players. And, you know, that's just awesome to hear when you're a guy coming out of college. It's just awesome.
Yeah, I was going to ask that element of it too, right? It's like, obviously, There are 30 teams. There are only so many draft picks. You're going to be happy to get drafted by anyone, but there are some teams that maybe your reaction might be something to player development wise, reputation wise. And then it's the Rays. It's like, oh, they're one of the smartest front offices. They're one of the best player development. I mean, it probably says something to you that they see a lot in you to pick you that high, right?
Oh yeah, totally. You know, like you said, there's some teams that are not, you know, the best with developing, and seeing like big teams like that, like I said, the Yankees, the Guardians were on me, the Dodgers were on me, you know, teams that are known to have a really good development program. It's just awesome to see, my abilities to play baseball. So
did you talk to the Jays at all, or they know you well enough from you being Canadian?
I actually did not meet with the Jays pre-draft. I met with them, in the fall with one of the area scouts, but we didn't have a strong connection, between each other. So
Big missed opportunity in Toronto.
It's so
you get with the Rays. Has it gotten to the, like, when you're having these conversations and you talk about the player development side, are they telling you stuff yet of like, hey, we think we can do this with you. Hey, we want you to work on that. Like, is that already started?
Yeah. So right now, like I said, I'm just getting acclimated with the people, meeting a lot of people. You know, there's a lot of people here working for me, and it's more of an individual career than, you know, in college. It's more of a, okay, we got to win right now. Here it's just a development of individual players. So it's on my own more than anything. But, you know, I have so many resources here that I can use. And so, yeah, like you said, it's more get going right now. And hopefully, you know, in the next couple of days, the coach are going to be, will have feel on what I need to work on.
So there is, I don't know if he's down there with you yet, but the Rays turn around, they draft another Canadian in Nathan Flewelling not long after you. Did you know, Nathan, like, have you guys chatted this out, two Canadians pretty quick together by the Rays?
Yeah, so I actually never met him. He's much younger than me, so we never got to play with each other. And no, as soon as he got down here, we started chatting and got to know each other pretty well. So it was cool to have, you know, a Canadian with me. But there's actually another one, Jack Lines, who's also a Canadian that got drafted by the Rays. And there's a catcher, Tyler Aaron, I believe, also got drafted by the Rays, and he's another Canadian. So wow. we have like a little crew of Canadians, so we hang out together, and you know, it's awesome.
That's great. I mean, four in one class. That's there have been years in the past where like there's not four Canadians drafted in the first 2 days, you know? Like this is this is good. So for you, I think you were the highest drafted player out of Quebec since like 2007 or something like that. I forget the exact number. What does that mean to you? Like, obviously, you have put on for Quebec at the provincial level. You've put on for Canada at the junior national level. What does that mean to you to be one of the highest drafted Quebec players in so long?
Oh, it means a lot. You know, putting my name in the same category as, you know, Philippe Aumont and those guys, it's huge. It's amazing. And I've had so many people reach out to me, and it's just been, you know, an awesome period of people reaching out to me. And, you know, it means a lot. It's just a little kid from Quebec who's been making a lot of sacrifices to reach his goal to play in pro ball. So it means the world to me.
So you just pronounced Philippe Aumont the very French way. I know you were on with RDS after the draft or leading into the draft, kind of joking around about how the Americans say your name. How do you want us to say it? Do you want us to put the French on it?
No, please don't. Please don't. I'd rather, you know, people calling me Emilien Petrie than Emilien Pitre. People can't it's just how it is. People can't roll their R in the back of the throat, and I like it better that way. So Emilien Petrie is what I want you guys to use.
All right. Are you a basketball guy at all, by the way?
No, not really. Okay. Not really.
There's a French Canadian NBA player named Benedict Mathurin, and I'll put Mathurin as the French, and then everyone's like, what are you talking about, man? So thank you for the permission to just say Petrie the rest of the way. Okay, man. So your game in general, you know, I can check out a handful of games in the NCAA tournament. That doesn't tell me everything. Read the Baseball America and things like that. And the first thing everyone says is, oh, advanced approach at the plate, mature approach at the plate. What does that mean to you? What goes into having, you know, such a well-structured approach when you're at the dish?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I consider myself a better hitter in established counts. So that means I love seeing pitches. I grind out at bats, and that's kind of my game. And so when I got to school, I didn't have an approach. You know, younger, I was just, you know, hand eye, try to barrel the ball every time. So I got to school, and that's the first thing we started working on, because if you don't have an approach in college, it's not going to work. And so, we started working on my approach a lot. And my first year, like I said, I didn't play much. And then that was my only focus, you know, approach, you know, work in BP, not swing at balls, swing at strikes only, and pretty much did that every day. And that's kind of how I got better with my approach. And, you know, it carried into the game. You know, sometimes it's hard to make that jump to a game when you don't play for that long of a period. And so my summer ball year of, I want to say freshman year, I went down to Bethesda, and, you know, it's kind of how I started, you know, playing again. And the approach worked. And so I stuck with it, and I didn't change it since. But that's kind of how, you know, the kind of hitter I consider myself, you know, approach guy that goes gap to gap. And, you know, sometimes I'll put it over the fence, but I'm just I consider myself very mature hitter, like you mentioned.
Nice. That's a it's a good way to be, and that translates, right? That travels. A ball's a ball, a strike's a strike.
Exactly.
At every level. I did want to ask you about one transition that you're going to go through here. I know you played in the Cape last summer. What is that adjustment like from two wooden bats? Like does that, obviously the approach wise nothing changes, but how big an adjustment is that?
Oh, it's definitely a big adjustment. You got to be more precise with the barrel, and so I would say the transition is not going to be really hard for me personally, because growing up I would only play with wood bats, and so I kind of, you know, I'm used to wood bat. But swinging a metal bat for 3 years and going back to wood is definitely going to make be an adjustment that I will need to make. But I don't think I haven't struggled with it so far. Obviously, I'm going to start breaking bats because I, in my opinion, good hitters get jammed. And so, I'll definitely start breaking bats here and there. But, it's good to just be more precise with the barrel, and just overall makes you a better hitter.
Nice. That'd be fun to watch. Okay. So, okay, I did my research, looked at your socials, things like that. I this is for the audience. There is not a lot out there about you other than baseball. I know that to make it to this level, to be a second round pick, to compete at that level at Kentucky, baseball has to be most of your life. But what else is going on? What else makes you you outside of baseball?
I just love hanging out with people. I always have someone next to me just to, you know, enjoy and talk and make, you know, I love meeting people. And so that's kind of who I am, you know. Back home, I didn't have a lot of people that had the same connection to me, the same passion as me. So it was kind of hard to relate to them. But here or at school, I have so many people that have the same passion as me. And it's just much easier to, you know, have conversation about baseball or about life just because we have the same, you know, passion. But yeah, I just love hanging out, you know, on the couch or going out to eat with the boys. That's just what I love doing. I'll play a little bit of ping pong here and there, pool table. I got into it, I believe last year. Brian Walshman's got a pool table down in Florida. So for Thanksgiving, I spend the Thanksgiving with his family. So it's awesome. They're great. They also are like 20 minutes down the road from here. So it's awesome. But yeah, I just, you know, I'm a people guy. I love talking to people, and I love, you know, hanging out with my friends.
Nice. Ping pong, pool, more hand to eye, you know, get the ball at the right spin and the right point and stuff.
Yeah.
Not barrel, but, you know, some of the same skill set. Okay. But before I let you go here, Canadian baseball fans, they want to, you know, obviously you can, MILB TV is there. It's a little hard, but you, the player, you, the person, what would you want Canadian baseball fans to know about you as you embark on this pro career?
I would want them to know me as a grinder, you know, a guy that's going to make it through the minor leagues, maybe not the fastest, but not the longest. You know, I'm going to take it year by year and, you know, just follow my career. I think it's going to be a successful one. And, just know me as a young little kid from Repentigny, Quebec. And, that's going to make it.
Awesome, man. Well, rooting for you very much. Thank you for taking the time out and doing this.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Emilien Petrie, now second round pick of the Tampa Bay Rays out of Quebec via Kentucky. Looking forward to seeing him getting into some minor league games and tracking his progression. Small trade while that interview was airing, not Jays related, kind of Jays related. Michael Lorenzen gets chased in the first inning Saturday, pitches a bunch of innings in relief on Sunday. He's a Kansas City Royal now for a left-handed relief prospect who ranks like 40th in the Royal system or something. So you get swept by the Jays, you start selling pitchers. Let's take a break. When we come back, Lindsay Dunn joins us to talk about her experience doing a little carpool karaoke with Kevin Kiermaier. That's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bit of a weird one here. Anyway, if you missed it before the break there, now I've got two songs playing in my ear. The Rangers turned around and dealt Michael Lorenzen to the Kansas City Royals after getting swept by the Blue Jays this weekend. I think we're back now. Joining us from the City News TO studio is the very busy Lindsay Dunn. Lindsay, good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Good to see you, buddy. Loving the tunes.
Yeah, oh, I figured you and Kevin Kiermaier are singing it in the car ride together. Okay, so some of this has hit social, some of this has hit City News TO. For anyone who hasn't seen it, on Friday, you did a ride along with Kevin Kiermaier. You drove him to work. You guys, or he sang, I don't know if you sang, it didn't make the cut. How did this all come to be?
Thank you for asking. I wanted to give the backstory of this. This is something that's been a year in the making because I was asking Vladdy at a game, and, you know, I'll ask about, you know, his swing and all that, but I always throw some random questions, and I don't know why, but I asked him, who's the best singer on the team? And he said Bo, but then enthusiastically said Kevin Kiermaier. So I had a follow-up with KK and see if it's true, which he confidently said, yes, he's the best singer. But for the last year, he's been telling me in City News viewers that he would sing for us. He was going to sing something. But I said, you know, I had enough of this. I'll believe it when I see it. I'm not interviewing you until it happens. Then at spring training this year, he comes up to me. He's like, the best time to get me singing is when I'm actually on my way to a game. So obviously there's a lot of storylines surrounding Kevin Kiermaier right now with, you know, the retirement that's going to happen at the end of the season and potentially being traded in the next 24 hours. So we made Friday happen and he finally sang. I'll let everyone know, like, this was like a 40-minute conversation where we talked about life. He sang the most random song selection I think I've ever heard. And he talked about the Blue Jays. He talked about, you know, actually being an MLB player. But that's how this all started. And it finally happened.
Okay, so the big question here, obviously, is he actually a good singer?
I actually, like, love this moment because I know you're going to air some of it. Is he was nervous for me seeing a professional athlete around little old me, this kid from Regina, Saskatchewan, being nervous to show a little bit of vulnerability just totally changed my, you know, impressions of KK. But I would say he has some pipes on him. I know I cannot sing, so there was no singing by me in this in any way.
Well, yeah, my move is, like, I will sing at a concert, but I'll sing at a nice low volume so it doesn't ruin anyone else's time, and I will sing alone. That's those are the two scenarios in which I'll sing. I'm definitely not doing it on camera with you on the drive. The other like logistical question is, who picked the playlist? Is Kevin Kiermaier coming to you and he's like, these are my five karaoke go-tos. These are the songs I know I can sing. I'm only putting myself in a position to succeed, or did you get to throw songs at him too?
See, that would have been the smart thing to do if it was Kevin Kiermaier. But the fact is, he had this playlist last year that they, you know, put out. It was something so many Blue Jays did. And I thought his was so random. It had, like, Bette Midler. It had Rick Ross. It had a little bit of everything. So, and Mario and Usher. So I was like, hey, let's sing some songs off of that. That's what I thought we were going to do. Then, no, he grabs my phone, goes on Spotify. He picks songs that, honestly, were random. It was not anything that was planned ahead, and that's kind of what happened. But if he wanted to be, like, 100% set up for success, I think he would have picked songs that he's like, these are the bangers I know. When I go to karaoke, I might be, like, into, like, a couple adult beverages that I can let her rip. But that was not the case. He just picked songs and had fun with it. And I'm honestly super thankful that, given all the storylines surrounding him, that he was willing to have fun on the way to the ballpark.
Okay, so you said you're not a singer, but before we aired this Kiermaier clip, if you had been put in a situation where Kevin Kiermaier is like, I'm absolutely not doing this unless you sing one too, what song are you picking?
I'm going to say Kevin's a jerk because he didn't ask me. I would have been Space Jam, Quad City DJs. That nice. Is my go-to. I can, everybody get up, it's time to slam. Now we got a real jam going.
Yeah. Oh, shocker, so you have basketball on the mind right now. I wonder why.
I wonder why. I don't know why.
Okay, let's play a clip from this. And obviously people could see more on socials. They could see more on City News TO. Let's play a clip of you driving to work with Kevin Kiermaier doing some singing here.
Every day I'm hustling. Some Ricky Ross to start it off. Okay, we'll be taking a right. Taking a left on good old Spadina. Called it Spadina my first, like, 4 months here, and everyone corrected me. So now I finally know it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you had to break the ice somehow. Let's do it. So she's got my playlist right now, hustling, and oh, she's got some good ones on here. But I'm gonna go off top of the head first. So when I sing, I pick the times when I wanna sing. I don't sing the whole song through, I kinda pick and choose my spots. So I'm gonna just act like, no, well, you're in the car, so I already have, like, this slight little pressure
on
me.
I'm not here, don't worry.
Okay, you're not here.
It's gonna be amazing.
Just let it ride out, you know? Baby girl, what's your name? Let me talk to you. Let me buy you a drink. I'm T-Pain.
You know me. Gun thing is
Nappy boy, wee. I should roll down my windows and let the people of Toronto hear. Some people call me the space cowboy. Yeah. Some call me the gangster love. Oh, God. Some people call me Maurice. Because I speak of the pompatus of love. Wow, that was... That was gut-wrenching.
Did you see the lady? Like, she
loved, yeah, she loved it. She loved it.
I honestly thought she was going to say.
The other guy wanted to flip me off, but we're not worried about him. See, usually I'm very handsy right now. Usually when I got the steering wheel, yeah.
There you go. Well,
so this song is a country song. It's ridiculous, but it's called Parked Out by the Lake, and it's the same words over and over, but it is one of my favorite songs. I'm still parked out by the lake, 80 miles from Santa Fe. And I will say, when I was singing, I wasn't super, you have a presence. You have a presence. You have a presence. I was a little nervous. Oh, Canada.
That leads me into my final question about Kevin Kiermaier for you, Lindsay. And that question is, he has been petitioning not so quietly for the entire time he's been with the Blue Jays to get to sing O Canada at a game. He didn't get to do it on either Canada Day. There's a weirdness here in asking this because he might not be on the Blue Jays the next time they play at home. But do you think we get one if he's on the team the rest of the way?
Honestly, I think if the Blue Jays were smart, they would let them do that because there hasn't been a lot of bright spots in this season, as you know, and let them sing, let them have fun with it. You know, it's something fans want to see. It's something that it's the most thing I've been asked about in the last year is when is he going to sing? When is he going to do this? But honestly, go to YouTube. The full thing is there. Just type in my name and then put Lindsay Dunn TV, Kiermaier. The interview's up there. He talks about, you know, his very, very interesting pregame routine back in the day that I've never heard before. And also, There's more singing, and he talks about the Blue Jays, some stories I've never heard, but they should let him sing. I don't get what there is to lose.
I don't think so. Like, I don't see why not. It's not, you know, no disrespect to the anthem singers who go out there every game, but no one's moving the needle like Kevin Kiermaier, I don't think, short of, you know, you bring in some actual musicians or whatever. You know, yeah, it'll be fun. Sorry, I don't mean to be disrespectful to the anthem singers. I just mean Kevin Kiermaier doing it would be the most notable anthem singer you could have. So Kiermaier is going to retire at the end of the season, as he's told us, as he told you, and things like that. How, like, what do you think post-career Kevin Kiermaier is like? Like, he would be such an obvious fit in media right away, but he also might just, like, go and do his, like, I don't know, live in his cabin outside of Indianapolis and bowfish forever, and we might never hear from him again.
I love that you said that, because I actually asked him, like, what do you want to do post-retirement? Because there's a lot of things he could do. And he has this custom shirt he made that says, you know, it has his number 39. And then it says Outlaw Bowfishing, Outlaw being his nickname, Bowfishing being the sport he loves. And he says, you know, maybe I'll do a YouTube channel, do a bowfishing thing in his retirement. So he said that could be coming to a TV or screen near us. So
all right.
I cannot see him not doing media, because he also said in the same interview, he likes his privacy. So it, like, contradicts itself.
Sure.
I know. I saw your eye roll. For anyone not watching, that was my thought exactly. But I think he'll do media. Like, I know he also talked about wanting to coach some of the outfielders, but I cannot see him not doing something TV related, because KK loves KK.
Yeah, he likes the camera for sure. Okay, so Kevin Kiermaier might not be here that much longer. The trade deadline is Tuesday. We don't know. You know, he banged into the wall and is dealing with the hip thing. He'd been placed on waivers earlier. Someone we do know for sure is gone, in addition to Jimmy Garcia and Nate Pearson, is Danny Jansen. And I wanted to ask you about that because I know you've had some fun with Danny Jansen. The teammates have had some fun with Danny Jansen over the years. Being a seller at the trade deadline's hard, eh?
Yeah, man, it was an emotional and awkward weekend at the Rogers Center, from Friday, from Yimmy to even Kikuchi speaking after, you know, an emotion in the dugout. If people were watching to see that, he thought this could be his last time as a Blue Jay. But with Danny going, even the next day, you know, a lot of the pitchers and the people in the bullpen and the players, and Varsho spoke about just your friends, your family, you're around these people more than your own family. And then it's like, yes, it is a business side. And a lot of times we forget that they have emotions. But Danny Jansen is somebody that I've covered extensively for almost a decade. And even at the beginning of this year, I had a conversation with him, Swanson, Romano, Davis, and Ernie, all about how awesome Danny is as a person and a leader on and off the field. So that was a tough one to see go. And I know a lot of people aren't too happy what the Jays got in return and never want to see him actually in that Red Sox uniform. But it was awkward. And I cannot stress enough how Danny is pretty much what you see is what you get. He is a genuine person because a lot of people will put an act on for the TV. But that's not Danny. He is kind. He is sincere. He puts a lot of hard effort and work in there, and he wants to see everyone else succeed. But it was tough this weekend at the Rogers Center, seeing all the emotion from people that we usually see pretty stoic.
Yeah, it's a tough part of it. And you mentioned Kikuchi there. Our pal John Morosi reporting just a few minutes ago that the Dodgers are in on Kikuchi along with the Twins, Padres, yeah, and Astros. So, you know, that's, we probably did say goodbye to Kikuchi on Friday. Some of us on the field pregame, some of us in the stands as a fan for that one, wanting to pour the last Yamazaki out for him. Lindsay, we are also temporarily trading you off of the Blue Jays. Ooh. Here. You are headed to the Olympics tonight. What are you going to be doing there? How excited are you?
I am over the moon right now. So a lot of people don't know this. I haven't spoke about it because this is my first Olympics. I am heading out there tonight. I'm actually going to Lille, France, because, drum roll, I'm covering the men's and women's basketball teams for every country, but great focus on Canada. And then I'll focus on the 3x3 team in Paris and hope they all have long, extensive runs. But I got goosebumps just hearing that I get to go to the Olympics, and I have no chill. You know, I have no filter. I'm sweating thinking about it, but I'm just so excited to be around like other fans. We've been watching these players forever and get to see them compete and then talk to them after. I don't know what world this is.
Oh, it's amazing. I'm so glad you're getting to go. And obviously we have Arash there, and then Dan Shulman and Megan McPeak and Nabil Kareem on the call for the men's and women's game and some other games. Women, actually, the 5x5 women getting in action here in about 20 minutes to start their tournament. Big upset in Canada's pool earlier today with Nigeria beating Australia. Canada, yes, obviously on the men's side, got off to a scary start, but okay, against Greece. And then you mentioned the women's 3x3. I probably haven't given them as enough. This is a Blue Jays show, but I fit in time to talk about the men's and women's 5x5 team. How excited are you for that one? Like, that team is so likable, like with Paige. And obviously all the content with her daughter, yeah, the sisters, and like a lot of success for that team. And it's just like they're playing twice in one day. It's a cool style of basketball. What can you tell us about that one and how Canada's looking?
Well, I was talking to them before they left just about how crazy their schedule is, because if you look at the women and men's 5x5 team, like, they have a couple days off in between, they get to rest. But for this, it's like every day, sometimes it could be twice a day. But going into this, their qualifications and games, it was a little sketchy, but then they play in Edmonton and some like pre-qualifier stuff and exhibition, and they just absolutely dominate the competition. What's crazy to me is people don't even have some of the stats. They don't have them meddling. This is a team that we should be all in on. They have the talent, they have the energy, they have the camaraderie, they've been performing on the biggest stage before. But I want to add about the Plouffe sisters, which, if anybody's been following Basketball Canada, they played for the women's 5x5 team before in the Olympics. They went to Rio and London, but they pretty much are the ones that brought the 3x3 team to Canada and in Basketball Canada. And they've been working for years for this moment, for them to kind of bring this game, this program to Basketball Canada, to now then go represent it for the first time at the Olympics in Paris. You cannot help but root for these Canadians. But aside from that, the actual sports question is, they should absolutely dominate, and I'm excited to see that happen.
They get underway tomorrow in pool play against Australia at noon. And again, the women's 5x5 in action 11:15 on CBC. Lindsay, you'll be there for the rest of them after today. Have an awesome time.
Thank you. Au revoir.
Lindsay Dunn of City News TO. Make sure you check out that entire Kiermaier interview on YouTube. Again, it's like 20, it's like 40 minutes of them driving to work together. And Kiermaier does more than sing. He talks about his time as a Blue Jays, prep as a player, things like that. And then make sure you're following Lindsay's work on the basketball side for the Olympics. Yeah, mentioned it. 11:15, the women 5x5 get underway. Men back in action at 7:30 tomorrow morning. So I will be locked into this studio before I do a 10 to 2. I'll be in here at 7:30 with that up on one of these screens that you can't see, ready to roll and texting, bugging Dan Shulman. Let's take a break. Let's bug Jenny Searle and Kevin Brown. Continue to talk trade deadline stuff and set up this doubleheader we got going on this afternoon as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays made three trades over the weekend. They also made three wins against the Texas Rangers to pull within 7 games of 500 and 7.5 of a wild card spot. They'll try to keep that rolling today in a doubleheader against the Baltimore Orioles, who are in a bad way. Around 11:30, we'll talk to Kevin Brown, voice of those Baltimore Orioles, about that. They have dropped 10 of their last 15. They're still hanging on in the AL East only because the Yankees have been one of the worst teams of baseball over the last 6 weeks. The Yankees making a move over the weekend as well to try to fortify things, picking up Jazz Chisholm Jr. Lots of trades in the AL East. The Tampa Bay Rays traded away, in addition to Randy Arozarena, which we broke down last week, they traded away reliever Jason Adam to the Padres for a pretty nice return. Now, Jason Adam, if you're comparing those returns to Jimmy Garcia, has a little bit more term and control there. They also traded Isak Paredes to the Cubs for Chris Morel and a pair of fringy-ish prospects, guys who don't make the, you know, don't make the top 30 in the Cubs organization, but they're guys regardless. So they were busy. Yankees were busy. Red Sox were obviously busy picking up Danny Jansen from the Toronto Blue Jays. And the Orioles picked up Zach Eflin, who will start today in the first half of a doubleheader. It'll be Yariel Rodriguez against Zach Eflin at 3. And then whenever that game ends, we'll take a 30 to 40 minute break. And it'll be Bowden Francis against Cade Povich, both of whom are coming up from AAA. So we'll continue to break that one down for you with Kevin Brown in the next segment here. Yeah, a lot of trade stuff still going to happen. John Morosi reporting that the Dodgers are in on Yusei Kikuchi, along with a handful of other teams that include the Twins, the Padres, and the Astros. I would be surprised if the Orioles weren't a name that had kicked the tires on Yusei Kikuchi as well. The Jays clearly showing with the Danny Jansen trade. They're not worried about trading rental pieces within the division if it means you get the best return. So that'll be interesting to track. Also interesting to track with regard to trade outside of Toronto. Jack Flaherty is penciled in to start today. I would imagine if you're trading for Jack Flaherty, you'd rather him not make that start. You'd rather, he get yanked from that one, and he starts for you later this week. We'll see how that goes. Let's break some of these trades down with Ginny Searle of Baseball Prospectus. Baseball Prospectus has been doing a tremendous job breaking all this stuff down, setting it all up. Ginny, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. So we having fun yet?
Say that one more time.
Are we having fun yet? All the trades going on.
Yeah, it's always busy with the trade deadline. I'm excited to see what happens next. But yeah, it's fun.
It is a lot of fun. I guess first, you know, I want to go into some of these deals with you. You guys have been breaking them down at Baseball Prospectus. Obviously, you have been doing this series on trade targets as well, some of whom have moved, some of whom are still very, very available. High level, though, Jays make three trades. What did you make of kind of this first wave of the Jays trade deadline? Looking, you know, 7 prospects back, no one at the kind of top of any prospect list or anything like that, but not bad for the early work, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Jays are in an interesting position. I think that they probably made the right choice to sell, just in terms of there not being a ton on offer for them this year in the playoffs. I mean, I think they probably, yeah, according to our standings, they've got like a 3% playoff chance even after these trades. But I think it just makes more sense to try to get some value, especially when, you know, you're 5-5 in the AL East. You can say another division, it might be better, but of course that's the problem. They're not in another division. So I think that it makes sense to kind of not do a full teardown or anything, because obviously they're not in that spot, but just kind of do a retool. I feel like this is the same sort of thing you're seeing the Rays do right now. And I guess it's sort of the smart thing that a front office does at this point, right?
Well, the Rays front office certainly, the Jays, at least so far, it's expiring guys or Nate Pearson, who is a reliever, so you don't worry, you know, he's not a core piece or anything like that. The Rays are trading core pieces left and right, though. Zach Eflin's got a year left with $18 million. Isak Paredes has got term left. We know this about the Rays, that level of shrewdness and like kind of a coldness to it. What have you made of their deadline so far?
Yeah, so I think that the way one of our other writers, Patrick Dubuque, described it was, he said, Randy Arozarena has 2 more years of arbitration left after this, which means that he's on an expiring contract for the Rays. Right. So yeah, I think the coldness is a good way to describe it. And I think that, you know, the Rays are never going to be really in competition for any big free agents, but there are considerations other than just like whether the absolute best value at any given moment's the only thing that you should pursue. And it makes maybe more sense for the Rays and the Blue Jays, who, in addition to being maybe a little bit better positioned for long-term contracts, also are actually going to sign those when the Rays aren't. So I think that you have a little bit less incentive to completely break things down to the studs.
Yeah, like to use an example, if Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. were both 1 year away from free agency with the Tampa Bay Rays, and Vlad was set to make like $25 million in arbitration next year, right, Vlad would be gone. The Tampa Bay Rays would have traded him away. With the Isak Paredes deal, did you like that one from the Cubs' perspective? I'm so curious how his offensive profile as like a dead pull down the line guy is going to play in a different ballpark.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting when you're trading for someone, even if it's not explicitly said, there's always a little bit of that hope with some players that they're going to give you a little bit more. And I think it can be risky because, you know, I think a lot of teams have faith in their player development teams that they'll be able to bring the most out of players. But, you know, sometimes a player just who he is, right? Like, I think Vladimir Guerrero Jr., for example, has been trying to not hit ground balls his whole career to back and forth results. So I think that, you know, hoping that I will be someone else than he is something maybe never, maybe rarely happens. But I think that Paredes has still been a valuable player. And I think that probably it'll translate okay. I think that maybe there will be some growing pains, but I think that the skill set should transfer okay to, I think, a new park won't be a too big of a concern.
So when it comes to a team like the Rays, we kind of, it seems like people have a healthy dose of, I guess, respect or benefit of the doubt with them where, you know, if they trade for a prospect, everyone kind of assumes the prospect's good or whatever. Now that they've cooled off right a little bit the last couple of years, but like still generally the track record is really, really strong. Through that lens, them taking the flyer on Chris Morel, who's obviously had a down year for the Cubs here, but has been, you know, not that long ago was a pretty top prospect, hit 26 home runs. What did you make of that side of it and what Chris Morel's future might look like?
Yeah, I think that the Rays are definitely an org that will prioritize absolute upside in a trade if they can. So I think that while Morel might be having a down year, I think that they might still be looking at the overall potential that's been seen from him in past lists, like the top 100 potential, stuff like that, and saying, well, you know, if someone can bring that out, we can bring that out. And I think that in general, the Rays, you know, they have roles for role players, position, you know, stars, etc. But I think that they do try to maximize the upside on deals. I think it'll probably be a little bit until he's ready for, you know, full-time big league action again. And I don't know exactly what the Rays will do with him, but I'd imagine they'll still play it, if nothing else, for just the years of team control. But I think that it'll be interesting to watch. I think the Rays are going to give him as many opportunities as they feasibly can. A change of scenery is not always the worst thing, I guess. And I feel like it might be the right time, which maybe is why the Cubs selected right now.
Okay, so let's look outside the Rays here a little bit. I know you had broken down Randy Arozarena as part of your trade deadline candidates series. Mm-hmm. Seattle adds him. I don't imagine they're done. That AL West, you know, Houston and Seattle are tied. The Rangers, I don't know. The Jays weirdly swept the Rangers, and the Rangers are 4.5 back out of that and traded Michael Lorenzen today. But when you look at that AL West, Seattle adding Arozarena as kind of the first salvo there, what do you make of that division race and Randy's fit in Seattle?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to count the Mariners out of the division, but I do sort of think that they might be playing for the wild card at this point. It was what, like a 10-game lead that evaporated in a month. I mean, I don't even think that they're like a hugely worse team than the Astros, but right, it's like, you know, 7 straight ALCS from the Astros. They've been here again and again. And, you know, I think that they were so worrisome earlier in the year because they did just kind of have that sense of a team that was old and suddenly done. But then comes, you know, a month later and they turn it all on. And it seems like it might be too late for the Mariners to get back into the division. but I think that, you know, it's still, even though they broke the playoff drought, it's still like what, one division in the last 20 years, or one, not division, one playoff appearance in the past 20 years. And that one wasn't a division either. So I'm sure they would love to get back into it, but I think that they have a strong chance at actually just sticking into the playoff race. And I think, you know, from their organizational philosophy, from any perspective, I'm sure that their team and their front office will be happy, especially because I think there's some heat on Jerry Dipoto right now.
Yeah, it seems that way. And had they not swept the Blue Jays in the playoffs, I don't know how fans would have felt about, oh, we broke the playoff drought and then we're out right away in an expanded wild card format. Okay, so...
Yeah, that first round helps.
Yeah, certainly. And then here you get the, you know, same kind of thing, but in reverse. If the Jays had won a playoff game or gotten out of the first round, maybe the conversation would be different, but they haven't. So this is the conversation here as they sell. The other team that engaged with the Rays was the Orioles. They picked up Zach Eflin, obviously new here to see the Orioles being buyers, to take on money. I mean, they didn't touch the top 10 of their prospects, according to the Baseball Prospectus list, but you still, you know, it's new to see the Orioles aggressive, and it sounds like they're not done yet. I know Zach Eflin was a part of your trade candidate series as well. What are the Orioles getting in Zach Eflin? What are we going to see today? He's pitching against the Jays again.
So I think that the Orioles, you know, perhaps they were golden by how well the Corbin Burns trade went. Maybe it's just finally kind of gone through that they actually can't have room for all of these guys. Right? Like, that's one of the big problems of having such a deep farm system. You're never going to find playing time at the big league level for all these guys, especially if, as it's gone for Toronto, they've had prospect after prospect work out at such a high level. So I think it's definitely time to start condensing, really selecting the guys that they want the absolute most and that they have the most faith in. And yeah, as you said, I don't think they touched the top 10 when they brought in Eflin. And you know, it's any reliable starter can do so much more for you in the playoffs. And I think especially the Orioles, they've got Burns, but they've had a lot of other issues with injuries, with underperformance, stuff like that. So I think that this is probably the best way that they can actually bolster their playoff chances, right? And I think they're really incentivized to take that division, keep it away from the Yankees. So I think that Eflin, you know, he's maybe not the kind of player who's you want with game seven, everything on the line, but they have Burns for that. So I feel like it makes sense that they're going to try to pull as much value and as much length as they can out of him, get him into as many games as they can down the stretch. But I think they could use one more guy, yeah. But with starters, it's always that way.
Yeah, it seems that way. And you mentioned trying to keep the Yankees away in the American League East. The Orioles do have a one-game lead right now. Neither of those teams playing very good baseball. And the Yankees go out and get Jazz Chisholm Jr. I know you and Patrick Dubuque wrote it up at Baseball Prospectus when the trade happened yesterday. We got a little look at Jazz as a Yankee on Sunday Night Baseball last night. This is an interesting one because, first of all, like numbers-wise, production-wise, Jazz Chisholm's like reputation maybe outstrips his actual production a little bit. And then he's also like this big personality, and he's going to the Yankees where like people are mad that he wore a green belt with the Yankees uniform. Like it's an interesting fit. What do you make of, I mean, not only the addition, but pretty good price there for the Yankees to play to add Chisholm.
Yeah, I definitely think that it makes sense if they brought him more, just, you know, with the injuries they have / always appear to have with their offense. It really makes sense to bring in someone who, I mean, Chisholm's also often injured, but he's a different profile than a lot of their really, you know, big, somewhat maybe slower power guys. So I think that he fits really nicely into their lineup. I do agree that, yeah, he's maybe got a little bit better reputation, and, you know, just he's got such potential. And I think people see what that obvious potential is. He's got the speed. He has a decent amount of power. I think in 2022, he hit 14 home runs in 60 games. But the issue with that is he keeps getting injured as well, right? He had 60 games then. I think he came into the season with, you know, 3 years of service time. So he'd been with the big league club for like 3.5 years and 300 games played. So it's just not ideal on that front. And then he had that 1 year with a good amount of power. But other than that, he's been pretty close to league average production with the bat. And it's not that that's not a valuable player, right? Someone who play center field, can play the middle infield a little bit, and can hit fine, but it's not a star player. It's not necessarily who the Marlins were hoping that they would get when they traded him one for one for Zach Gallen. I think now that the books close on that deal, you might say that turned out better for the Diamondbacks and the Marlins, but they got him for not that much, and now they can really hope to see more of that power come out. He's walking more than he ever has. He's striking out a lot closer to league average than is his norm. So he's staying on the field as well. I think that if there's a time to him to have an offensive breakout, it's right now. I'm not really sure why the Yankees are playing him at third base, or well, I guess they haven't yet, but they've said that he's going to be their third base backup when he's never played an inning there professionally.
Just go and get an infielder.
It's an interesting decision. Yeah, well, you know, it's a good thing that they don't put much pressure on the acquisitions in the Bronx, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, it'd be a tough one. It suggests to me that if they think they're done, they shouldn't be. They should go get someone who can play a little bit of third base as well. Okay, so that's a lot that's happened already. There are still a lot of names out there, again, including some people you've done your trade target series on. Tarek Skubal, probably top of the list in terms of actual quality of player. I still have trouble seeing this getting done.
Do you
have not a sense from a reporting perspective, but like, does anything make sense for you in terms of like a team that would actually pay the price it would take to get 2 years of Skubal away from the Tigers?
Yeah. So I think that I sort of struggle with this when I was writing up the trade series, because I was trying to decide, well, what's the chance that he's actually going to get traded? How likely is it that the Tigers decide now? And I feel like I usually, just from a personal perspective, come up against teams trading really talented young players like that. Like, I think when Juan Soto got traded first to the Padres, and now again, I really thought that seemed kind of wild to me, the kind of guy that you put a statue in front of the stadium of, right? But obviously, Skubal's a pitcher, which makes him less of a sure thing going forward regardless. But he's also 27 and just having his breakout. He'll be over 30, I think, by the time he gets free agency. He's not going to command the kind of, like, huge dollars on the open market. But also, he is a Boris client, so I don't think the Tigers were going to sign him to an extension. And the question really becomes whether you think the Tigers have a realistic shot at contending in 2025, 2026. I think he's a free agent after 2027. I could be wrong there, but whatever is time left, the Tigers, they're like a middling prospect team. I think they're on the rise a little bit, but they were 15th dead in the middle of our organizational rankings coming into this season. It's just hard to see, especially because they keep running bottom third payrolls now. It's hard to see where they bridge that gap and become, you know, not just a team that keeps getting closer to 81-81, but actually is a team that, you know, even getting to 85 wins you need to get to the playoffs seems like a little bit of a stretch right now, let alone 90, which you've actually needed in some years, right? Not just the complete fringe if it's a bad year scenario. So I just don't think it's going to happen for the Tigers right now. And the front office is still relatively new. A lot of the poor decisions that you might put on the team aren't really reflecting on them. So I think that they have at least some leeway where they can make this trade and try to figure out what their future is and how they want to push things without getting a ton of backlash. I said it's kind of bleak to trade someone like Skubal, but I think, you know, with the Angels last year, for instance, you see that there is a cost, right, to not trading these guys and going the other way.
Yeah, there certainly is. So it's a tough one for them to think about. Similarly tough for the White Sox with Garrett Crochet, because the White Sox are like three decades from competing. Before I let right, you go yeah. here, Ginny, team you're most curious about or interested in between now and Tuesday at 6 p.m.?
Oh, okay. I don't know how this fits into expectations, but I think I'd say the Dodgers because it's been a while since they've made a big splash, and maybe they don't really need one, but I feel like that Scherzer Trey Turner deal that we got in, I think, 2021 is still like the biggest free agent deal that we've had in a while, depending on how you want to rate the Soto, or I'm sorry, not free agent, biggest trade deadline deal we've had in a while, depending on how you want to count the Soto deal. And I don't know. I mean, it's not like they're not bad. Obviously, they'll never be bad in 100 years, I guess. But this is the probably the weakest that they've had their team in a couple years, and they put so much improvement into their team already. And I just think that if they're trying to go for the World Series, then someone like Skubal, someone like Crochet, maybe is the way to go. And so I think that maybe they're the team with the most incentive to pull things over the line. If not them, then the Orioles.
And then, yeah, if not those high-end guys, maybe the top rental name, and Yusei Kikuchi. Send us some prospects here, guys. Jenny Searle of Baseball Prospectus, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Jenny Searle of Baseball Prospectus. Make sure you're checking out all Baseball Prospectus' stuff. They're breaking down every trade that happens. They've got lots of preview stuff up on some of the top candidates out there around to trade for. I'm going to take a couple texts in the text line. You can text us always at 590-590. Standard messaging and data rates may apply. We're going to do a lot of that tomorrow because it's a four-hour show. We got a lot of good guests lined up, but also there will be a lot of waiting for more news to happen. Last year we got blanked. We didn't even get a rumor about the Blue Jays on trade deadline day. We'll hope to do a little better this year. So a couple texts there again, 590-590. Simon and Shelburne asked, are the Jays rushing pitching depth because of the huge void they have leading to all these injuries? No, I don't think so, because you look at Landon Moraitis is one of the guys. He was at A ball in his first pro season. He had pitched 10 innings. I don't know what you do with that. He's only 19, but like he'd thrown 11 innings at A-ball. They certainly didn't rush him. Brandon Barriera had barely pitched at all, and he was pitching in the lower parts of the minors again. Yeah, he was a 20-year-old repeating at single A. He threw 1 1/3 inning and came out. Ricky Tiedemann if they were going to rush Ricky Tiedemann would have had a role with the major league team at some point this year. Instead, you know, almost all of his season was spent on rehab assignments, only pitched 17 innings across the complex league, single A and triple A. And then, you know, Manoa, I don't know, maybe you could make the case that the later start to his spring training because of the shoulder injury there. And maybe he could have had more ramp up at AAA. I don't know, but there's not really like Moraitis, Barriera, and Tiedemann have barely pitched and haven't really been rushed whatsoever. In fact, in the case of Tiedemann, you could probably make the case that given the injury risk in the profile, you could have pushed him harder to try to get some of those innings at the major league level before the eventual elbow injury. And then Adam Macko. I mean, Adam Macko spent the entire season at AA and was only pitching every sixth or seventh day to start the year as he worked back up to a regular starter routine, a regular starter workload. So I don't think it's a rushing thing. I think pitching injuries are high risk anyway. Some organizations take more risk than others when it comes to pitching injuries. The Dodgers, for example, are a high risk team that have a lot of pitching injuries throughout the minors because they kind of embrace risk because there's an upside with that risk. This is definitely something worth examining, and the Jays are surely trying to figure out what the issue is. But I don't think it's a rushing thing because none of these guys were pitching. None of these guys were pitching high in the minors or getting pushed really. A few people texted about Emilian Petre and how the Yankees looked at him, the Rays drafted him, the Dodgers had talked to him and things like that. Where were the Jays? Yeah, I mean, he said he talked to them the prior fall. And I don't know. I haven't heard it. Like, I know the Jays liked Nathan Fleueling, who the other Canadian that the Rays picked. Not sure about Petre. It's worth mentioning, too, that the Rays drafted Petre earlier than we expected Petre to go. So we don't know that the Yankees and Dodgers were interested at a second-round level. Maybe they were interested at a third, fourth, fifth-round level, things like that. And like you said, he talked to about 20 teams in total. But yeah, anytime if a Canadian guy hits, also it was a great interview. He's a good guy to talk to. I certainly wish he was in the Jays organization. It would be a lot of fun. So we're going to take a break here. You can continue to text us today and tomorrow, 590-590. Standard messaging and data rates may apply. We'll sprinkle a lot of those in, especially tomorrow when we go 4 hours. We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we'll set up this doubleheader. Jays playing in Baltimore at 3 p.m. Once that one finishes, get a 30-40-minute break. Start game two, Yariel Rodriguez against Zach Eflin, then Bowden Francis against Cade Povich. We'll take this break. We'll talk to Kevin Brown, voice of the Baltimore Orioles, set this one up on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Yes, lots of trade stuff, lots of trade slop. Trades have happened. There will be more trades to happen between now and 6 p.m. tomorrow. There will also be two Blue Jays baseball games. They got a doubleheader against the Orioles today as part of a four-game set. They'll play four games in like 48 hours. 3 o'clock today, then the nightcap, then a 6:35 one tomorrow, and then a 12:35 one on Wednesday. Busy couple days for our next guest, the busiest guy in baseball. He's doing Sunday Night Baseball alternate broadcast last night. It's the voice of the Orioles, also part of the Sunday Night Baseball Statcast broadcast. It's Kevin Brown. Kevin, good morning, man. Thank you for doing this. How we doing? All right, we might not have Kevin Brown after all. We will try that again in just a moment while we reconnect with Kevin here. Reminder, it's the Ariel Road. It's Yariel Rodriguez against Zach Eflin today. All right, now we got Kevin Brown. Kevin, what's up, man? How are we?
We have a doubleheader today. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Before we talk about that, man, how was the – so you are – for anyone who doesn't know, ESPN2 does a Sunday Night Baseball alternate broadcast, the StatCast broadcast. You guys did the second of, I think, 6 last night. You, Mike Petriello, and Trevor May. How are you enjoying those?
It's been a blast. This is, like you said, the second of it. It's a new thing this year. There was an alternate StatCast broadcast for 3 or 4 years. And then the last couple of years, Michael Kay and Alex Rodriguez did this alternate show called the K-Rod Show, which is more of a casual conversation show with a lot of guests. And now we're back in the StatCast world. It's really fun. I love this kind of stuff. I use a lot of it on my broadcasts. The coolest thing we have on screen is we have this thing which has been developed by a company called True Media. It's the pitch predictor. And on the top right side of the screen, based on the count, based on the handedness of the batter, you have the top 3 most likely pitches in that count. So it'll say, okay, Carlos Rodon versus Jaron Duran, 65% fastball, 30% slider, 5% curveball. And then we have the heat maps of where Rodon throws a curveball and where Duran does damage on the curveball. So then if Rodon throws it into his heat map and gets a strikeout, we look like geniuses. And if he throws it into Duran's damage map and Duran hits a home run, we look like geniuses. And if he throws it into Duran's damage map and he pops it up, we can say, well, he got away with it. But it's a great conversation. And Trevor May is a super, super smart and interesting guy. And Trevor has been out of the big leagues for not even a year. He pitched for 9 seasons. He pitched with Oakland. He pitched well last year. Mike Petriello, I think, has been on your show before, he said, and you all know him. And
yeah,
Mike is just a brilliant baseball mind and able to break down seemingly scary concepts into really simple, digestible information. So we've had such a great time.
Yeah, and yeah, Mike's a friend of the show and a regular. Trevor's been on the show as well. So this is the Jays Talk Plus altcast as well. It's very much up my alley with the three of you. You said, though, that's your favorite visual. I disagree. I would put my favorite visual at, I now know there's someone else in the industry whose notebook looks more like they're the Zodiac Killer than mine, and that's Trevor Mays that you guys blew up on screen. What's going on with that thing?
Yeah, Trevor brought in his actual handwritten scouting report from the Red Sox last year, and I think we've solved a few cold case murders in the 1970s in San Francisco as well.
Yeah.
He's got all these handwritten notes about how he attacks certain hitters, when to throw pitches, at what times in the count, damage zones versus zones where he has success. It's really neat. I think we're going to do more of that in the weeks to come. And if he wasn't planning on doing it, I just said we're going to do more of it. So tough for him.
Well, that's great. Okay, let's pivot over to the games you're calling today. We got an Orioles Jays doubleheader. Orioles have been busy. We're going to see Zach Eflin on the mound in one of these. Orioles picked him up without having to touch kind of the top 10 consensus in their farm system. We saw the Orioles be pretty aggressive in the offseason with the Corbin Burnes addition. It's the first time in a little while here we've seen them as pure deadline buyers. What do you like about the Eflin addition for them?
I like everything about the Eflin addition. I mean, we'll see what the prospects in the trade end up being. Obviously, when you trade with Tampa Bay, you always cross your fingers and hope you didn't just trade the next three MVPs and Cy Young winners. But Zach Eflin fills a huge need. Kyle Bradish has been out for the season for a while. So has Tyler Wells. So has John Means. The Orioles have really been stitching together the back of the rotation for a while now. Dean Kramer came back from injury last month. They've been relying on a couple of rookies. They've been relying on Albert Suarez, who's 34 years old and hadn't pitched in the big leagues in 7 years. These guys have filled the void admirably. But they could not go into a postseason series with the current rotation. Now they feel like they can. They have Corbin Burns, they have Grayson Rodriguez, and now they have Zach Eflin, who was sixth in American League Cy Young voting last year. Is not quite the same this year, but I think the underlying metrics are really good. I mean, he has a 409 ERA. His expected ERA is 338 based on quality of contact. He's second in all of Major League Baseball in walk rate. Does not allow a ton of hard hit contact. Has pitched really well against the Orioles in the past, too. So I think our hitters were all really excited to see him on our side. You get, I think, dependability, consistency, innings, and a guy who just hates to walk people. And he's under contract for next year, too. Mm-hmm. And to your point, like Zach Eflin's owed $18 million for next year. And, you know, the Orioles have not been a true buyer for a while, and it's been a long time since they would consider something like that, like absorbing a salary for $18 million for next year as well. So I think this stabilizes the rotation this year and next. I think it gives the Orioles a third pitcher that could genuinely pitch in a postseason series. I don't know that they're done. I don't think they are. I expect them to make multiple more moves in the next however many hours before the deadline, 30 and a half or so. But it filled their most glaring need.
If they add again, as you're suggesting, and I think, you know, that's certainly the read on it from over here, too, is that, hey, if you're going to go in for Zach Eflin and you've got one of the best farm systems in baseball, like, get after it. Keep going. Where do you think they might look to address? Obviously, there have been some, you know, rumors out there about every team needs bullpen help. And, you know, maybe Mullins and Mountcastle are available as outbound pieces. Where do you think the Orioles would be looking to continue to fortify?
Yeah, three spots. Number one, they need another starter. They maybe don't need it as much now that they got Zach Eflin, but I think they'll probably go try to get at least a rental starting pitcher. I do think they need a fourth starter in case of injury, and they could still upgrade on the back of the rotation. Number two is the bullpen. I mean, literally every contending team needs a reliever. Maybe except the Phillies now because they got one in Carlos Estevez, but they're competing with the Yankees and the Dodgers and every other team that wants to make the playoffs. The Red Sox are in desperate need a reliever. So I think the Orioles will get a reliever. I don't know that they want to overpay, but they'll get a reliever. And then number three, they could use a right-handed bat. Now, the lineup is looked second in the majors and runs scored, and they just traded a right-handed bat in Austin Hayes, but they felt like that was the right deal to get Sir Anthony Dominguez, who's a really talented right-handed reliever. I think they need another right-handed bat. They've really struggled against lefties of late. I think they could use a right-handed veteran outfielder. I think then maybe try to do that, dipping into, again, the back end of the prospect pool. So three needs, and will they get all three done before 6 o'clock tomorrow? I'm not sure. I think they'll probably focus pitching first, and then a right-handed bat would be a little bit more of a luxury after that.
Well, on the pitching, on the rental pitching front, maybe Yusei Kikuchi just changes clubhouses over the next 2 days or something like that. Kevin, outside of the trade stuff, this is a Baltimore team that hasn't been playing its best ball lately. Obviously, they are one of the best and most dangerous offenses in baseball, but 5-10 over their last 15, a couple guys that have cooled off at the plate. What have you seen in how the Orioles are playing during this rougher couple weeks here?
I think it's a team that's dealing with some young player problems.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, it's an incredibly talented group. It is a pretty inexperienced group. These things happen, right? The Phillies, I think, have won one of their last six series. The Yankees have gone 12-23 over the last 35. So, you know, the whole league is a reminder that you don't just play great baseball for 162, but specifically to the Orioles, this is a younger team. And when things are going well, there's energy, there's vigor, there's incredible talent, and that's still there, but you see a team that's pressing. I mean, Gunnar Henderson has made an error in four consecutive games, and Gunnar Henderson is one of the best shortstops in baseball, and he'll be fine, and he'll get out of it. But he's pressing, and Brandon Hyde has said that and noted. He thinks this team is just pressing as a whole. Adley Rutschman has had trouble identifying the right pitches to swing at, the right pitches to take in the past month, which is unusual for him. They could use, and it's funny for me to say this because, as you noted, I'm on the StatCast show, but they could use a veteran guy, right? They could use a clubhouse guy, and it's a good clubhouse, good high-character people. They're loose. They're fun. That's not the issue. It's not a clubhouse of jerks at all, but they could use a veteran guy. Maybe they'll get one in the next couple of days that just brings a certain gravitas experience to the clubhouse, somebody who can stand up in a team meeting, somebody who can keep spirits high when things are going wrong. And Zach Eflin is incredibly well-regarded, so I think he'll help in that respect. But last year's team had guys like Kyle Gibson and Adam Frazier, who, again, weren't the statistical darlings of the team, but were great at keeping the train on track. And for the most part, the train has been on the tracks here. The Orioles are still in first. People are stressed about the team here in some ways because the stakes are now high, but they're not that far removed from having the number one pick a couple of times in 300 lost seasons. They're a first-place team going for back-to-back titles in the American League East. So perspective is necessary, and on the whole, it's been a great, great season. But I do think they'll shake out of this, and, yeah, I wonder if the deadline moves in the next couple of days have an eye towards that, you know, bringing in the right guy to inject a little extra veteran energy into this group.
And hey, man, look, this is a analytics forward show. You're on the StatCast broadcast, but that stuff's real, man. It's they're not, you know, I don't think anyway they're mutually exclusive. We have all these expected stats and then what actually happens. And I do think things like, hey, having a guy in the clubhouse, good leadership, things like that, someone who can calm the nerves or bring the collective level down. That those are things that help us explain that difference between actual and expected and stuff like that. So I'm with you, especially for a young team like the Orioles. Kevin, we got a doubleheader today. Joe Siddle was on our broadcast yesterday afternoon. So it's Ben Shulman on the call because Dan Shulman's at the Olympics calling a Canadian women's basketball game right as we speak right now. And Joe was kind of filling Ben in on, you know, some of the tips for a doubleheader, what you want to do, how to stay hydrated, things like that. What is your game plan on a doubleheader day?
Yeah, I have placed orders for an acai bowl and for a Cuban sandwich from two local eateries. So once I get off this call, I'm going to go pick up the acai bowl and the Cuban sandwich. I'm going to get the acai bowl for a pregame meal. I'm going to have the Cuban sandwich in reserve for an in-between games meal. I don't have much more than that. I just need to stay hydrated and stay well fed. Game two ends up being a little bit more of a bare bones broadcast from a, you know, pre-made graphics perspective, just because you'll be more reacting to what happens game one. But I would say hydration is always important. It's not new for me though, because I take this giant like gallon level water bottle jug thing that I crush every day. So I'm just an overhydrator in the first place. I don't drink anything but water during the day. That's literally it. And I haven't had anything but water during the day for years. So hydrate, make sure you have some pre-made food because you don't want to be scrambling in between games because maybe the press room will be open. You know, maybe there'll be some pizza. Don't leave it a chance. Have some food. Have some pre-made food. Take some time. If you don't get the lineups in right away, it's okay. Walk around, stand up. You don't want to be sitting down for 18 innings. Very American of us, just be sitting in a chair for 6 hours. So take extra stretches, right? There's not just the seventh inning stretch today. There should be the third inning stretch and the fifth inning stretch and the eighth inning stretch. We got to stay loose. It's not just the vocal cords. It's the body. And now I feel like I'm sounding like some kind of a yoga teacher.
No, it's great. The breath comes from the diaphragm, et cetera, et cetera. You got to be ready to go. It's not an easy job physically.
Breathe in, breathe out, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, pre-arranged food is the most important thing.
Okay, the last one for you here. The other thing you have to prep for on a doubleheader day is there are 27 players. to prep for instead of 26. Cade Povich is going to be the 27th for the Orioles. We've seen him.
I believe this.
Pardon me?
I can't believe this. 27 players. I can't do that. I mean, that's way too much work.
Yeah, it's a lot. But so we've seen Cade Povich up a couple of times. And we saw he made his major league debut against Toronto. Obviously, he's been up and down a little bit. What are you looking for from Cade Povich in this one after a couple starts down in AAA?
Yeah, strikes. I mean, what I'm always looking for is strikes, and more strikes. He's walked 4, then 0, then 5, then 1, then 0, then 3, then 5. So it's just inconsistency of command. I think this stuff is good enough to pitch here. It doesn't throw hard, but the curveball's really good. The fastball's sneaky. It's just been command with him. 2 starts ago against Oakland, they gave up 8 runs. It was command out of the strike zone early and then command within the strike zone. I thought he was better against the Yankees his last time. He only gave up 3. He struck out 6 and 5 and a third, but again, 5 walks. The Yankees will do that to you. And obviously the Blue Jays to a lesser extent than the Yankees, but they will do that to you. They walked 4 times against Povich in his debut in Toronto. It is really, really, really simple and obvious, but it is all about command with him. And the starts he's won this year, the Orioles have won 2 starts of no walks. And then the start against the Yankees, that was a weird one. 5 walks, only 1 hit, 4 2/3. Yankees were scuffling there, some weak contact. He's got to throw strikes. It's big league start number 8. I think as he gets more and more experience, he will. The tough thing is, this is kind of the Orioles' dilemma now, and it goes back to what I said. It's getting experience for young players in the middle of a pennant race. Cade Povich is going to be a lot better in 5 years for what he's going through now. Same with Chase McDermott if he comes back up again. Same with Connor Norby and Jordan Westberg and Gunnar Henderson and all these players. But they are all developing now. So it's the talent that needs to play. And in some cases, obviously, you're talking about every players like Gunnar Henderson. But the experience of this level, the experience of really struggling in the majors for the first time in your life, and doing that all while you're a game ahead of the Yankees, that's what can make it fun. That's also what makes it really difficult. And I hope Cade Povich will learn from that first Toronto start and be a little more consistent throwing strikes. Look, the Orioles yesterday got 4 2/3. Out of Albert Suarez. So they won, but they had to use 4 relievers, which is not what you want going into a doubleheader. So hopefully Zach Eflin has a nice long start in game 1, and then hopefully Povich can give the Orioles some innings and some quick innings in game 2. Because as you mentioned, 4 games in about 48 hours here with the noon game Wednesday, this is not going to be a series for the faint of heart in the bullpen.
Yeah, it's going to be, it could be, it's a very short 4-game series, but it could be a very long 4-game series.
Yes.
With pitching changes and things like that. With that said, Kevin, I should probably let you go here, man. Thank you so much for taking the time out.
Blake, always a pleasure. Thank you for having me. And if you ever want me to come back again, just ask Mike or Trevor.
All right, will do, man. Kevin Brown, Orioles play-by-play, as well as the Sunday Night Baseball alternate StatCast broadcast on ESPN2 select Sundays throughout the season. Love Kevin Brown. Love his calls on the Orioles. Love those StatCasts. I caught a couple innings of the StatCast alternate broadcast. Don't tell anyone because we technically didn't get it here. But yeah, nice to hear our pals, Mike Petriello, Trevor May, and Kevin Brown chop it up on that broadcast. I would love to do something like it sometime. It is Yariel Rodriguez against Zach Eflin in this first one here. Yariel Rodriguez, obviously 3 of his last 4 starts have been excellent. There was one short one mixed in there, but he's been more pitch efficient. He's gone longer into games. He's using that fastball really effectively. This is an Orioles team that is going to test him because they are the number 3 offense, arguably the number 2 offense in baseball on the season by a couple different statistical measures. They have hit more home runs than any team in baseball. Struggling a little bit over the last month or so, I mentioned. They're 5-10 over their last 15. They've been about a league average offense during that stretch. Gunnar Henderson's cooled off. Adley Rutschman's cooled off. Jordan Westberg's cooled off. Still, though, a lot of lefties, a lot of power. So for Yariel Rodriguez, who's been pretty split neutral so far, and is honestly even reverse splits at time, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting. This is an Orioles team that can, if they want, grind out at bats too. They'll probably do that in the first leg of a doubleheader, see if they can get into the Jays bullpen, see if they can get Yariel Rodriguez's pitch count up. This is obviously a Blue Jays bullpen that, while it has nominally 8 guys, it is thinned out in terms of quality because they've traded so many guys away and lost so many guys to injury. Luckily, the Jays didn't have to use anyone out of their bullpen on Saturday. And on Sunday, they only had to use Yennesis Cabrera and Zach Pop. So a pretty fresh bullpen, all things considered, for this doubleheader. Yariel Rodriguez has not faced the Orioles yet. Bowden Francis has had a couple scattered appearances against the Orioles, 27 plate appearances overall. They are 8-for-26 against him with a pair of home runs. Both of those home runs coming from, guess, yeah, Ryan Mountcastle. Of course, Ryan Mountcastle. Any Blue Jays pitcher stat you look up, the home runs will be from Ryan Mountcastle. In fact, Ryan Mountcastle is rumored to be available in trade, and I'm fairly certain the Orioles are just waiting for him to get two more games in against the Toronto Blue Jays to make sure that value is nice and high. On the other side of things, the Jays just saw Zach Eflin, obviously, had a pretty solid start against them Wednesday as a member of the Tampa Bay Rays. The Blue Jays as a whole have seen Eflin for almost 100 plate appearances over his career, a pretty low strikeout rate, but Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is the only guy who's really got to him for power. Springer has one home run. Vlad's gotten to him for two. Jays as a whole hitting .266 off of him with a .436 slug. Justin Turner's kind of struggled against him. Kevin Kiermaier struggled against him. Dalton Varsho struggled against him. So weirdly, the lefties have had a tough time with him, despite him obviously being a right-handed pitcher. And then Cade Povich will start the other one, as Kevin Brown helped us set up there. Cade Povich made his major league debut against the Blue Jays. Didn't go particularly well. He's been up and down a couple times. The AAA numbers are great. He's got a 3.39 ERA over 13 starts at AAA, 30% strikeout rate, single-digit walk rate. It looks good. He looks the part of a top pitching prospect. When he's come up to the majors, struggled to miss bats at anywhere near that level, struggled with his command a little bit. The walk rate goes up. You look at some of the stuff, how the pitches look. He's not blowing anyone away. He's more of a, kitchen sink kind of guy. And maybe those guys are going to take a little bit to figure out how to pitch from a pitchability perspective at the major league level. There's obviously potential there, but he's a guy that the Blue Jays will want to, they had a successful start against him last time out. So you want to do that. You want to get into an Orioles bullpen that is not as well rested as the Blue Jays bullpen, as Kevin Brown laid it out there. Four different relievers going yesterday, including 30 pitches for Yennier Cano and 22 for Jacob Webb. So I'd imagine those guys have a yellow. Cano might even be just down after throwing 30 yesterday. So this will be interesting to see how that plays out. The Orioles obviously very active in the market as buyers, the Blue Jays active in the market as sellers. We'll see if there are any changes to these rosters between now and 3 p.m. The Orioles have added Zach Eflin. They also made that trade for Christian Pache and Sir Anthony Dominguez, which shores up their bullpen a little bit there. They sent Austin Hayes out to the Phillies in that one. They'll continue to be active there. The Jays, of course, have traded Danny Jansen, have traded Jimmy Garcia, have traded Nate Pearson. Yusei Kikuchi is available with teams like the Dodgers and the Padres and a few others said to be in on him. I would imagine Justin Turner is available. Kevin Kiermaier, we'll see if he's in the lineup today after banging his hip off the wall the other day. Even names like Chad Green, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, who appeared in two games on a rehab assignment on the weekend, by the way, looked pretty good. He'll get into another game tomorrow if he's still a Blue Jay. He'll get into a game for Buffalo as the shortstop and then could be activated from there. We'll see how that goes. The Jays will also... it's a doubleheader. You'll get to see a little bit of everyone. We'll probably get another Stuart Baroa appearance. Addison Barger might get another start to build off a pretty decent game yesterday. Brian Servin will probably appear in his first game in a long time for the Blue Jays here. It's going to be interesting to see how that one plays out. The Blue Jays haven't had like a true backup catcher in quite a while. They have had, a split time duo here, sometimes even a trio over the last couple of years. So it'll be interesting to see how this one plays out. Again, it's 3 p.m., so no Blair and Barker in their normal spot for you today, but they will have Jays Talk for you between the games and then again after the nightcap. We will be back tomorrow at 10 a.m. for a four-hour trade deadline special, so we'll have lots of guests rolling through for that one. We'll break down any other trades that happen, continue to talk about the ones that happened over the weekend, and then keep you updated throughout this one. Thank you to Emelian Petrie for joining us, to Lindsey Dunn, Ginny Searle, and Kevin Brown as well. Thank you to Nick Blackmore, Amit Mon, and Jennifer Rolnick. Behind the Glass. Thank you for listening. Again, we're back tomorrow for 4 hours. Get your texts ready. Get your Twitter questions ready. Get ready to break down all these prospects. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a wonderful Doubleheader Monday.